Hello and welcome to Series 3 of Tell Dem, a podcast hosted by The Masher in partnership with Transmission Roundhouse, generously funded by the Paul Hamlin Foundation.
This series, we're shifting things around a bit, bringing you bold and unfiltered discussions around decolonising theatre.
Every episode, we'll be joined by amazing theatre makers from the global majority, discussing power structures, global influences,
what they do, how they do it, why they do it.
We're your hosts, Gidiga
and Beth,
and you are tuning into episode number 2. This podcast contains themes that listeners may find disturbing, triggering, or uncomfortable. Reach out to me. Welcome back to episode 2 of series 3, the Tell Dem podcast. We've got two very exciting guests, and those are
Vinay Patel and Izzy Raby.
Exciting.
Yeah, writer and director. But both talking about, is the theatre industry in this country overly literary?
Yeah, and we really deep dived into talking more about audiences and the influences that they have on global majority artists when making work. And we also dipped our toes a little bit into global forms of storytelling and what it means to actually want to make work that in the way that our ancestors used to make them.
Last time, me and Githika were talking about our work as the regional associates at The Masher, and where we'd got up to on our journey was starting to talk to artists and theatre makers in this country about their practice, about their barriers and what they'd like to see changed. Something that we did fairly early on as regional associates was to set up these some dramaturgy roundtables in Leeds.
Yeah, we did one in Manchester and we also did one in Birmingham too.
Yeah, so we were really fortunate to bring together about up to like 10 theatre makers, and we got to really talk about what does decolonising dramaturgy mean to them and their practice.
And it was really interesting because off the back of it, when we spoke to artists and got some feedback, the main feedback was about how there isn't many spaces held for global majority artists like that, where they could feel safe enough to explore, to lead and to dream. And that was pretty cool.
I think the biggest takeaway for me was that a lot of people going into this, going into these roundtables, didn't realise that their work was decolonial already by design, and that a lot of people came out of that process with a renewed sort of awareness that had come about through being in a collective space with other theatre makers. And that is what I think led us to starting this podcast. We wanted to get people around a table together, having these conversations, but put them out into the public so that people can share in this dialogue. It's a conversation. So please send us your thoughts and where you want us to take this podcast to next. Today, we are thrilled to have with us Vinay Patel and Izzy Raby.
Yay!
Big up. So, Izzy Raby is a queer theatre and film director, facilitator and music maker from Mid Wales. Izzy was the first Welsh trainee director at the Royal Court Theatre 2020-21 and an associate artist at Pentabus Theatre. Last year, they won the 2023 Ursella Award for contributions to Welsh arts and cultural activism. Izzy is hot off directing Feral Monster for National Theatre Wales, a banging new musical about navigating love, identity, class and family as a queer teenager. And recently, Izzy was directing Baba June with the Other Room Theatre and Grand Ambition, which is a one-woman show about growing up in Swansea, Wales, with an Iranian father that also toured to San Jose and San Francisco.
Be cool. And we're also joined by Vinay Patel. Vinay is a writer for theatre, TV and film from London, who studied an MA in writing at the Central School of Speech and Drama. For stage, he's known for An Adventure, which premiered at the Bush Theatre, a sprawling epic story about Kenyan Indians across three continents and inspired by real-life grandparents. I caught it at the Bolton Octagon. It was stunning. Vinay is also known for Sticks and Stones, a powerful piece about the power of language, which appeared as part of Payne's Plough's Roundabout season, and also a sci-fi reimagining of The Cherry Orchard with a fully South Asian cast at the Yard Theatre, which also toured as well, right? It went on tour.
To Home in Manchester.
To Home in Manchester, and I saw it there too. I'm basically a massive fan of your work. I'm literally fangirling right here. I'm like, ah, Vinay's in the room.
Yeah, I think between us, we've caught like all of these pieces of work.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having us.
For giving us an excuse to not write.
Yeah, I was going to say, I was like, thanks for not letting us tackle admin, you know?
It's nice to get out of the house sometimes.
It is a venture to North London from South East.
Yeah, where did you guys travel in from this morning?
Lewisham.
Kennington. So,
I'm saying that's like, on the Bakerloo line. There we are.
Say like Lewisham, like I know what these places are, but anything above Birmingham, I'm like, yes. it's all London to me. Do you know what I mean? But what we wanted to kick off the podcast, this episode, with a question, which is we're asking all of the artists that are joining us on each episode. And I'm really interested to know about what's inspired you this week. And that can literally be anything at all.
Thanks, Vin. I'll kick off. I'm gonna go really hella gay and say my partner, which because she's working on a really cool piece at the moment called Super Mary, which is all about sort of Polish Catholicism and queer identity and bringing it together, but using like punk music and Catholic songs, which I'm just so curious of like how that's gonna work. And so we're watching loads of documentaries on the history of punk at the moment, and I'm like, love punk music, so that's been really fun. And just like, it's joyful just kind of how she's just interrogating that kind of like cultural context that she comes from in a way that is just really, really exciting. And so we were just having great conversations about punk music, Catholicism and sexism and queerness last night. And so I'm gonna say her.
That's so cool. Nice. And also amazing, but maybe not sometimes, that you share a space with a partner who's an artist also.
Yeah, I mean, she's a modern classical composer, but does a lot of work with like contemporary dancers, and so it's like we do different but similar, and it's been really useful, you know, because we can kind of bounce off each other, but we're not like too much up in each other's spaces. But yeah, so that's my inspo for this week.
Nice.
Oh, I've got. That sounds great. I want to see that. I've got a few things, but I'll pick one. I saw a film called Robot Dreams this week. Was it over the weekend? I don't know if you know about it.
No, is it like a recent film?
It's a recent. It was up for Best Animated Oscar, I think. It is a Spanish-French film about a dog who adopts a robot or buys a robot, depends how you want to see that relationship. And it's set in 1980s New York, and it's this real mix of like, it's very detailed in its cityscape and like the way it pulls in minor characters and their stories around it. But it is fundamentally this really beautiful story about, I thought it was going to be a thing about, oh, there's a lonely dog, which there is a lonely dog who gets a robot and they're good friends. And you're like, I thought, oh, that's going to be the whole story. But it turns into this really profound piece about sort of leaving people behind and how that's kind of okay, but also really difficult and part of life and the guilt you carry around that and the way you process it. And the animation's like, it looks like it's a kid's movie, but a lot of it, I was like, I don't know if this will go over the head of lots of kids. But the main thing I really loved about it is that it's it's entirely wordless, I think. Mm-hmm. And so it reminded me of a very pure form of storytelling, I guess, in terms of like, I remember when I was making my first films and studying, there's a real sense of like trying to build narratives that you can just tell what's going on from what you're seeing in front of you without language. And it was just lovely to see something really playful and profound.
Wow. Was it pitched as a kid's sort of animation?
You make the assumption, don't you, that like, oh, it's an animation that's like, that's going to be have a kid's. And I think a friend of mine like told me they brought their kid to it and they were like, oh, they really enjoyed like a lot of the fun, because it's very visually playful as well. It's like very Jacques Tati-esque, but it's also like, how do you move on from a relationship you sort of accidentally abandoned and stuff? And I was like,
oh my God.
Not today.
Not to spoil it. Yeah.
I guess we've got to learn those difficult emotions.
Just let those kids ready for their own abandonment.
Yeah.
I mean, that also really, I think it kind of leads us nicely onto our, one of our big questions for this week, which is the British theatre scene overly literary? Which I think there's a nice, there's an interesting connection there in terms of like the power that images have alongside words. And I guess when you're, if you're making a film like that, you're writing a, you're creating a script that is all about what people see and experience and feel rather than like the language that's used. So that's our like first meaty question that I guess we're going to jump into
But
today.
Also, I'm interested to know what inspired you this week.
What inspired me this week? Oh,
I can go first if you want, because mine is similar-ish to Vinny's in that it was also a Pixar, it's a Pixar animation. But it's a film called Elemental, which is it's not new. But my wife, oh my God, she's my wife.
Oh, congratulations!
Yeah, thank you so much. We only got married like last week and I've just got used to saying that.
No way!
So my wife has got a new Disney Plus subscription. So like she's just trying to get her money's worth. So we sat down to watch this Disney movie and I'm really skeptical because I didn't really grow up with Disney. So I was a bit And then we put this film on, Elemental. And I was completely, it just blew me away. And it, have you guys seen it?
It's so funny because I was literally talking to someone about it over the weekend because we were talking about how great Inside Out is and how excited we are about Inside Out 2. And then they were like, Elemental's also brilliant. It's like, you so need to good. Check it out. So it's on my to watch list.
Yeah, put it on your watch list. Have you watched it?
No, well, funnily enough, I was talking about it weirdly just the other, because it was one of those films that came out and didn't quite get the pickup. And then there's that thing that happens when people go, oh, actually, this was really great, and people really slept on it. So
it was, honestly, it inspired me so much. And again, a similar thing in that there wasn't there wasn't that many words in it. But the depth that the story went into was so incredible. And it was also that thing of imagining a world from nothing, because animation allows you that thing of going, it can literally be set anywhere, like doesn't really matter. But then also that it really, for me, spoke to like generational trauma the like family of the main character. They were like immigrants who were coming to a specific area, but it doesn't necessarily say what country it is. But there's nods to people's ethnicities and heritage, and then I don't like, I'm not going to do it justice, but it really left me, like it stayed with me, and I've not stopped thinking about it. So that's completely inspired me this week. Beth, what about you?
I'm going to go for Birmingham has inspired me this week. I've been working from home this week, and so like very much feel like I'm in the area that I'm living in. Also, This Town came out this week, the new Stephen Knight drama. And just feeling a bit like, putting Birmingham on the map and watching it and going like, oh yeah, that place, or that place, that place, that place.
It's about a band forming in the 1980s.
So
in case anyone doesn't know.
And sort of starts with the Handsworth riots, which is sort of kind of local legend sort of event that took place. And it all sort of sits around punk and ska and all of these sorts of music forms that were coming together at a time when there was like, getting big waves of immigration from Jamaica and Ireland. And I'm yet to see a brown person, but I'm pretty sure in the series, but I've only watched episode one. But yeah, we know there were lots of brown people knocking around as well. Just like feeling energized about Birmingham and
great.
Okay, shall we go on to our first question then of basically what this specific episode is about and what we want to put on the table? And it's a really open question that can go in any which way, any direction. But I'll put it, I'm going to slap it on the table, and then I'm going to go really silent, and then someone's going to do some speaking. So this is how it goes. The question is the British theatre scene overly literary?
So I'll immediately back that back to you and ask what you think literary means in the context of British theatre.
And I'm going to bat that to Beth.
Oh, this is tennis.
I was going to say, we're basically having a game of tennis.
Yeah. Literary. So, I mean, in terms of structurally, I would say literary departments are a thing. A big thing, mostly I'd say in London, more than outside of London, literary departments where you have essentially the way to commission new work is by reading scripts and a script submission process where you receive the written word in a form that is sort of, that's generally accepted as the way that theatre exists on the page. And that there is someone whose job is to read that script and decide, is this good enough? Is this our theatre enough? Structurally, that's how I would describe the literariness of British theatre.
Yeah, and also, like, because when we've been talking about it too, it's like from, because obviously we're directors, right? So it's always a thing of like, it feels to me anyway, I'm not going to speak to you, but it feels to me like a lot of commissions usually always start with writer first, which also feels quite boxy in that there's lots of people with theatre makers more generally. And also if you are a director coming to it later, it's like how much influence have you actually had with that writer going on that journey together instead of coming in, churning out something, taking it to press and then it goes on tour. So there's also that thing as well that we've been thinking about when thinking about it being overly literary.
So now we bat the...
That's spicy.
It comes
spicy.
Back to
It's so interesting because I think where we are at with theatre at the moment is that there is more of a joyful emphasis on the visual and sound in a way. I think it's always existed, but it's really interesting now if we think about how we are incorporating, I know certainly with my work, more movement direction, more projection, more kind of, I'm feeling we are working in a more kind of integrated approach with visual narratives as well as, you know, like the written word. And I find that's really interesting. I work a lot with stand-ups and something that we kind of, it's really interesting working with stand-ups because they're wanting to kind of create more shows with lights, music, physical theatre in a way that, you know, hasn't really existed before. So I feel like we're at quite an interesting point in performance, whether it's stand-up or new work, where that emphasis on the literariness of things is starting to kind of evolve into being something that's more kind of interdisciplinary.
Yeah.
I don't know what you feel
about
that.
Think that's really true. I think it's like, it's funny, isn't it? I remember like when I was, when I studied writing, there was it was at a point, because I'm quite old, there was a point where the thing that was, you're sort of told that was good, and I think there's a discussion that we'll probably get into about the way that craft is sort of about expectations, both in terms of the organisations you're in, but also a cultural one. So if you're trying to find a form of dramaturgy that's outside that, it's also about understanding what the expectations of both the artists and the audiences are and where those conflict and how you navigate that. Anyway, that for later.
Oh, that's so juicy.
That's for later.
Yeah.
When I was training, I remember it was a real big thing. There was a type of play where it was like sort of rapid fire back and forth with like, and it's just the dialogue and nothing else. And I understood that as, you know, not necessarily a literary thing, but it was a primacy of word and it was about dialogue and the way. And I guess there's a performance emphasis there as well, because it's obviously those can be only articulated through the actors. But I guess because I came from a sort of more filmy background or a photography, like I was always writing in images and thought and thinking, I found it very difficult when like they'd say, oh, the first thing a director does is take out stage directions. And I found that like that seemed mad to me because like, I think in stage images as well, you know, I think in the mise-en-scene, I think it's not, I didn't think that the job is so split as you do the words and then the director does the visuals. Yeah. Like, I do think in those terms, and I found it really difficult that that was the way we conceived of how, you know, literally being trained, right? That was seen as the way to do it. And that was emphasized not just on the writing side, but also on the way that directors were working at that moment. So I'm glad I mostly ignored that. And like the stuff I write now is trying to, like I've got into my head of using the phrase theatre maker because I find it really generous. And I think the reason I love working in theatre is because I love working with other people. Otherwise, I'd be a novelist. And so
yeah,
I love writing stuff that is an offer to a sound designer, to a movement director, you know, to a director more generally. And they can ignore that entirely. But I think I really love the way I feel like things are slightly developing towards a more, about thinking about the show, right? And the beginning of thinking of the show starts with the person who's putting down those words in the first instance and holding in that as part of the DNA of it rather than something that's put on afterwards. It's like, no, it's part of the way you're conceiving it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think what you're saying there about that collaborative process, something like I really relate to, because I really believe so heavily in like to not come in with all of the answers. Like I don't, and I feel like that's quite an old school way of looking at director. It's like director is God, director is knowing everything. I mean, obviously I come in with ideas, you know, I have a sort of vision. But for me, what's so exciting is, as you say, that meeting of halfway with actors, you know, and like the creative capacity of actors, I think, has been so overlooked in the past. Mm. So for me, creating a rehearsal space where we are trying out a lot of ideas together, seeing what sticks, and also, again, checking in with the writer and being like, how do you feel about this? Where are you, you know, like just having those like open channels of dialogue for me is really exciting. And also kind of like having that faith to kind of step back and kind of like watch the work develop for me is always really important and really joyful.
Yeah, no, and it's, sorry.
Well, I was going to ask, do you think that there are structures in place that allow for that sort of collaboration to really happen in the early phases of developing work in terms of, I guess, the conception of an idea, the conception of a performance, essentially, yeah.
Well, I think this goes back to literary departments, right, and kind of in terms of R&D processes. And again, that's something that we have to fight for, isn't it, right? You know, there isn't, like, endless resources to kind of R&D work. And I think it can just really depend on the institution you're working with, how much money they have, or the company you're working with and how much money they have. You know, I think it just goes back to that very boring sort of fact of like, what are the resources of the kind of creatives that you're working with in terms of how early you step in? But I also think it really depends on the kind of work you're making sometimes, yeah, you know, yeah. Really, really depends.
Yeah, no, I think it's the overly, like I'm trying to, the small part of my brain that's trying to remember that there'll be writers who really resist the notion of theatre maker. I want to allow space for the idea that someone becomes a playwright, specifically a playwright. But there are people for whom everything about what being a playwright means, what theatre means, comes from the idea of it starts with someone being locked with their own thoughts, for better or worse, in a tiny space, and like articulating that as fully for themselves first and then bring it out into the world. So I think what would be useful, I'd love to see, and maybe, you know, that sort of thing is part of a legacy of more literary style of development. I'd love to see more thought go into going, what's the actual thing that this needs? And I feel like I'd love to see real proper consideration of what the aims of a workshop are ahead of time, that being agreed with the writers or theatre makers ahead of time. So you know what you're targeting. Mm, otherwise, it just becomes a slab of like imploding dreams.
I love that as a phrase. I think it's so true. It's like, you know, for me, I think, again, what was really amazing when I like was at the court was like I really honed my craft in terms of how to facilitate writers, how to kind of really sort of being very direct and like, what is it you want from this? Yeah, yeah. What is it you're trying to make? And I think that should be the purpose of a workshop or an idea. It's like, literally, what are your hashtag goals with this? For me, again, it goes back to what you're saying. It's like, it's why we make theatre, isn't it? It's because it's about, we love people and we love bouncing off people. So,
I've had this time last year, I had a really joyful workshop experience. I just want to, basically it was adapting a piece of work, and it's like a very big, knotty, difficult thing. We got given a week and I hadn't written a word of it. right? I hadn't written a word of this thing. I had an idea of what I wanted to do with each bit, and I was able to articulate that. But we got to work with the director, other creative producers and facilitators, a set of actors, composer and set design, like having those people in the room at the start of, and we had like fragments of stuff, and we were like, let's play with that, or let's see what happens when we do those transitions. Like, oh, that's a great image. We could run that through. And just something about it being that early allowed for all those questions. It allowed for everyone to go, I don't know. And I got really used to saying the words, oh, I suspect, or like, I wonder, or, and it was great for me again, because I didn't have to write anything about it. but in terms of facilitating the way I then have gone on to write that, and to take something that was very literary, because it's literally a book, and find the theatrical language and gestures that would really shape it. There's something about having gone, oh, it's useful, finding the right point. And usually that's later than you think. In this case, having it really early in the way that you would when you're, you know, devising a piece almost, that was wonderful. And I've never had that before. And now I'm like, oh my God, I'd love to make all sorts of, you know, with the, you know, maybe it won't be the exact people you're working with, but knowing, oh, that's what a designer's eye on that moment is. That's what an actor's eye on it really early is. That's what their gut instinct, what that is. And it's really wonderful.
That sounds like such a beautiful process that you've been on. And also, like you were saying before as well, Vinny, that some writers, that might be their dream, that might be their literal nightmare, and they just might want some time. And I think that's the main thing to say, is that like every artist is different, and it's like, who are those people, and who gets to say that that's excellent and that's really bad? Because I think that's also an important thing to talk about, and like, who gets the power to decide? Is it with the director? Is it with the writer? You know, and do we always have to put it in front of people at the end of that process of development?
And I think it's sadly this very, we are so outcomes driven, aren't we, in terms of our funding structures and how our institutions operate. So I think it's very difficult to resist. Like, yeah. I mean, obviously I love to resist that, but as in for the institutions that are employing the people to do the work, to not do that, sadly. And it's really interesting when you're saying the kind of people that you're putting stuff in front of, because I always feel, especially if you have a marginalised identity, unfortunately, even when you're giving space, there is always, because unfortunately, theatres in the UK, like very few have been created outside of the lens of white supremacy. And from outside of a colonial structure, it is so difficult to resist and to operate in a way that is not that. No matter how inclusive you're trying to be, it's still really hard for institutions to do that. So I think something that I've found really interesting, a few things that I've directed recently, is how the institutions that I work with struggle when there is not a concrete answer to the ending. It's really interesting when you have a bit of an open ending. I'm like, I want my audiences to go away and be like, oh, I don't know what was happening, I don't know how I felt about that. That for me is really exciting. But it's something that I've, with a couple of projects recently, I've had to really kind of like be like, no, it's good that the audience are a bit confused. It's good that like they feel complicated by something. And again, I think that's very like Western dramaturgy of like the idea of chronology, the idea of outcome. And for me, like, there's this quote, and I don't know where it's from, but I look, for me, I'm like, art is about creating questions and not providing answers. And I feel really, I don't know who said it,
but I've heard it before, though. It's a good one.
It's a good one, but it's something I really like live by with my work. I'm like, I want that expansive energy, you know.
So do you find yourself often in that position, as almost like you're having to kind of be the barrier, almost like defender of the writer from the sort of the institution?
I mean, yes, sometimes. And I think that also for me, I think it's also because of, I'm sorry to say, but it's also because of capitalism, right? It's like, we want to know what we're selling. We want something that's really concrete. We want something that's really clear in that way. And I think that's another thing that, again, when you're operating, so difficult to operate in an institution that is, you know, going to be like, okay, let's be a bit more. And at the point we are in history at the moment, where institutions are so scared, there is such limited funds. you know? Yeah. So I think this is all contributing. This all contributes.
Oh, there's so much there. Yeah, there's like, so what's, yeah, I mean, like the first thing you're saying about funding and where you put it in front of people, like I remember so much of, it's been a while since I've applied for a project grant, but I remember so much about the Arts Council funding in particular is about how that work and development process, that work can be useful to other people beyond the artists, which I understand is a good and useful intention, but can sometimes really mess up the process. So I think, yeah, there's a pressure in terms of the way funding bodies look for outcomes to the funding that they create. So it's like, if we give you this amount of money, you have to demonstrate this amount of engagement. So you can sort of see how that seems like a good thing, but can be really frustrating if you're going, well, actually, that wouldn't be helpful for what happens here. And then totally what you were saying there is about the saleability of something. Like it's a big thing in like telly and film stuff where I've done things where I've written like 4 expansive outlines of a film and they're like, right, now you can write. It's like, I don't want to, I'm dead. Like I know exactly everything about it beat to beat. Like I've done it. Like there's nothing to explore there. And then I think there is a third thing there, which is a more general political thing. And I think it's across the spectrum. And the idea of that, I think there is a slight suspicion towards ambiguity in work. I think people really want to know what you think about everything, because otherwise, you know, are you someone I can trust? And again, I understand where that instinct comes from, but it is very crushing to, especially part of the creative journey involves you being wrong about stuff. Like I can't remember where I read it, but especially in rehearsal process, someone articulated it as being allowed to be wrong until you're right. And ambiguity allows not just for an audience to, a space for an audience to come in and have a real, you know, ponder, but also space to frankly to be wrong. There's no point trying to challenge the way dramaturgy sits and works if you can't bring an audience on that journey. Sorry, I'm talking much again, but I remember like when I first started out, the thing they'd always tell you is like, oh, writing is about, you know, you've got to write the thing that's the most important thing for you. And I was like, right. But what becomes really apparent is the thing that I think is most important as like a brown man is not going to be the State of the Nation thing for other people. Sure. It's not going to stand in for greatness or interest. And it'll become an anthropological exercise. So they think I'm looking at that to learn about what those people get up to. Rather. And so, and I realized, oh, wow, it's so much bigger than you can't just, I don't feel like I have the luxury of just writing the thing. I feel like you also have to create the world in which that thing can find its audience, find the people who really need it and love it, but also allow space for it to be understood in a more intricate way from an audience that maybe has been trained enough. So I think the thing that I get really anxious about with certainty is we really love the play that makes us stand on our feet at the end and clap our hands and tweet about it. And we sort of, even as a writer, you go, oh, I don't want that one PN. So people go, oh, it's not like, you know.
That's so interesting, though, because I've heard that sentence being flung around a lot about amongst dramaturgs and literary departments about, we just want the artist to write what's, you know, what fuels them and what gets them going. And actually, you know, I wonder, Vinay, if you were a white man, if you did actually do that, maybe it would get people standing at the end because it's a certain type of audience that's coming in. And actually, is that something that you have to navigate with your identity and your background to actually never be able to write what is, you know, what is fueling you and what you actually want to say? Like, yeah, you never get that privilege.
Yeah, maybe. I think, I mean, I feel like I'm on a slow motion trajectory to making everyone who would normally be my ally hate me through my work. But I guess I'm interested in complicating the idea of what is, I'm told, is certain about me as a person in the world, because I think, especially like it, we talk about in terms of dramaturgy, in terms of it from other countries, in terms of a sense of global majority. And I think that, you know, in particular, I find that as a someone in the diaspora and like 2-3 generations down, that's a very fraught question, because, you know, I don't know how to embody dramaturgy from Northwest India, especially since my family haven't lived there for over 100 years now. So the sense that that's something I inherently have an idea of, as much as I would love to, you know, I'm as basic as someone who really loves a Chekhov play as much as was, right? Yeah. But there's a truth for that. But I also love, you know, I remember seeing Tokyo Story at university, which is an Ozu film, it's not a dramaturgy built on conflict. It is about a very close look at these just grandparents visiting their kids in Tokyo and turns out modern life is intense and a lot of the kids are dickheads. But and that's really lovely. You know, I was like, that's what my grandparents must think about me. And it was really connecting. And that was from the 1950s. And it was a culture completely far away from me. And yeah, I've gone down a rabbit hole, but I find I want to be brave enough to make work where at the end, the people assume will love this work are going, I don't know what I just saw, which is how you end up doing a brown sci-fi Chekhov.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, I've spoken too much. I'd love to hear what you think. Sorry.
I was also going to jump in on there because I was wondering whether like thinking about, in terms of these funding things, you're often asked to think so early on, who is your audience for this? Yeah. And I find that question always impossible to answer. I find often people, like makers from the global majority, expected to say, well, I am this specific identity, therefore my audience are all going to be made up of people who look and sound and, you know, are from exactly the same place as me, but in order to tick boxes, essentially, in order to go, well, yeah, we're doing the work or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I find it so limiting, and also then puts that business case kind of almost makes it worse for like people from the global majority, because you could be like, well, it's just going to be this one intersection of society that's going to actually come and enjoy this, when that's just not, it's just not true. It's just not truthful.
And actually, I just want to ask the table from that, thinking about audience, because I think that's a really, really important point, is that like how do audiences and everything we've been talking about affect global forms of storytelling? So Vinny, you mentioned that about like, you know, us being here in this country and not necessarily wanting to or knowing how to speak to our ancestors and the way that they told things. But, you know, is there a need for artists like us to learn from our ancestors potentially and have that space to go, actually, they told stories like this. Can I just try and tell a story like this and see if that works for me?
I think it's so interesting when you're talking about a global sort of way of working, because something I am, as a director, and I don't know if you both feel this, but something I'm so conscious of is how short the attention span of my audience now is. Uh-huh. So with my work, I am constantly also observing how long you can sustain certain moments and engagement. And I think that also is coming from an applied theatre background, engagement is always, and being, you know, my background is in applied theatre, but within kind of very extreme mental health context. And sometimes it was so much like, how do you just keep someone in the room? But I feel like that has really kind of transferred over to like how I am as a director now is, and it's like, again, it's the bells and whistles, right? But using the bells and whistles to kind of tell the story in as exciting and dynamic way as possible, whilst also being so aware of the fact that, you know, for people to sit down in the dark for an hour and a half and just look at one thing is now a challenge. You know, we're not in the, you know, unfortunately, like 20 or so years ago where 3.5 hour productions were more of a thing, you know? And so it's really interesting talking about kind of global, because I'm like, I feel that's everyone now is working within the realms of, I mean, it's really interesting. Feral Monster, the show I just directed, there was this, it's such a fast-paced piece. And then there was this kind of payoff of a 3-page monologue, right? Spoken by the lead. Becca Hayes, phenomenal Welsh actor. Shout out to Becca. And they managed to sort of really sustain it. But I was also so conscious. Something else that I did, because it was a real quite a galvanizing speech and getting the audience very aware of their inherent kind of prejudice against working class young people, is I, to make them, just to keep them even more, I brought the lights up on them. And I normally hate that, right? I hate it when I'm in a theatre and I do that. But I was like, there's something about that moment that really called to me. Mm. And it was a speech that was given at a funeral in the play, right? So I was like, I really want us to all be present at this funeral together. So I'm going to bring those lights up. And it was really interesting how that maximised that engagement. It was being held completely by the actor as well, but it was something I had to fight people on it. People were like, oh, I see, it's a bit that. And I was like, no, but I know. The minute lights are going up, if people at one point start drifting off, they're going to be aware of each other. And the whole point of the speech is about that. But again, it was something I had to fight for.
Mm. That is so fascinating.
But I'm like, that's something for me I'm always thinking of as a director. And also as a director that's at the moment working in comedy, which is so about like, bam, bam, bam. You know, it's so rhythm driven. It's so like, it's something I'm very hyper aware of.
Mm. That is, yeah. I mean, you've haunted me exactly. only because like, it's a thing. Like, I remember when we were doing Cherry Orchard, like there was a real thing about, part of the reason I wanted to adapt to Chekhov is because I love that sort of dramaturgy that is of taking a certain amount of time for the small feelings and frustrations, contradiction of character. It's funny because like I read lots of Chekhov's diaries, and even then it was like, audience doesn't know what the hell's going on. Like, they're like really frustrated and like fidgety. And I remember like it was a real, and I have, you know, I'm writing two massive like 3-hour long things at the moment, and it's funny because the way, having defended a certain slowness and going, oh, no, we like, is this a chicken and the egg problem? Is part of the reason people can't sit with it is because we sort of don't expect that, which feels like a very loaded thing to say. But I'm very anxious about the idea that engagement is about the bells. But having said that, then the thing that I've written that is slightly longer is like, I am thinking about the space. I'm thinking about how long someone sitting in the dark listening to two people talk each other about something they might not care about. Like, it does feed into my process more in a way that I've never done previously. And I find that my worry, you know, I'm constantly having that fight with myself, is like, is it a bigotry of low expectations to go, an audience can't sit still for 3 hours watching this if it's the right thing that compels them? With my experience of going, well, for some people that's really difficult and something, yeah, that's not even an expression of like of interest. It's just a part of their being, and so there is a real tension and oppression with sitting in that space. So holding that, and also the idea of going, theatre is competing with other art forms in terms of what is fun and what they want to bring people to. And I remember when I was starting off, you know, my instinct was, what's a play I can write that I can bring my friends I play football with to? Mm-hmm. And it's not anything I'm writing now. Right? So it becomes different audiences. But I was so fascinated to hear you talk about that from a director's perspective. And like, do you, I guess I'm really interested in, sorry, just like for you, and like when you're building a piece of work with applied theatre background, and also it seems as a devisor and like an early stage shaping of that work, what's the point we think about an audience?
I mean, it's great. I mean, for me, I think the audience is always there, like floating. I think it's really interesting, you know, just go back to your question about kind of like integrating, like, I guess, ancestral forms of performance and ancestral form. I'm like, it always all used to be integrated, right? If we go back to like the early, you know, like movement involving the audience, dance, music, it was all the same thing.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So I feel
that...
We didn't
sit quietly in you know, and in the dark.
Exactly. And that, yeah. And I think that that's really interesting in terms of, I'm always conscious of that, but also when I work with writers, I don't sort of project that onto them, and like that's my job, I feel, as a director. My job is often kind of like, I have responsibility to the audience and the writer. So it's picking my moment when I'm gonna really like think about, okay, how do I sort of like bring these two worlds together? But I think also like writers are also thinking about that as well. It doesn't of course it doesn't lie solely on me, but again, when I'm starting to think about design, lighting, sound, I'm thinking about how I articulating this story best in a way that is going to be both the most engaging it can be and also like the honouring of the story I'm telling.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I'm obsessed with marketing of plays because I'm very cool, but mostly because I think that an audience's engagement with a play starts before they step into this. Like, what's the thing they're looking at? And when we talked about an adventure, Lovely and Madly Eunice was like, got to make sure she's smiling on the poster. Like, no one's ever smiling in Bramley. And I was like, yes, it's so true. Like, it signals something to the audience about the type of play you're going to see. So, you know, part of me, you know, I know there's a real purity of people going, I just want to write and not think about the audience. And I think there is a space and time that not. And like, I tell newer writers, you have to write as if Twitter's not on your shoulder every single line. Otherwise, you'll never write anything that's interesting or difficult or compelling to you. But I sort of love thinking of audiences. And in terms of like again, to come back to your question about ancestral forms, I went to see Dev Patel's Monkey Man the other day, which is like watching Dev like just violently attack people for 2 hours was like quite a mood. But it was fascinating because, you know, for him, you could like, there's like, it's the film explicitly talks about like the John Wick movies, and there's like a bit of old boy in there, and it's like, okay, that's stuff that's really interesting for you, but like it's based on the Hanuman myth, right? That it's an ultra violent modern like action movie, but it has its basis as a Hanuman myth. At the premiere, he said something, his grandfather was there, and he said to his grandfather, "This started with you telling me those stories over the kitchen table," which is how I heard those stories as well.
Wow.
And I found it really really moving that the articulation and the speaking back to the ancestors was to take that and shape that into something that he found his joy and you know, excitement and love in. And so even like, even though I'm not really the audience for that kind of movie, and I was like bloody hell, like, you know, both blood and abs, he's doing it all, you know.
Yeah.
It's making us all look bad. It was just like, yeah, even though it was not like my vibe, I sort of loved seeing that was, you know, because he co-wrote, directed, starred in it, produced, and it came from his grandfather telling him a story that is thousands of years old across the table.
I love that idea that like something, and if we keep something in its ancestral forms, almost like that thing that you were saying of like it feels like a lie. Like I often feel that of something of, you know, being born. It feels like almost appropriation of a culture,
yeah,
like that is and both isn't mine at the same time. And so I love that idea of things evolving and you making it real and true to now, whilst also still being so conscious of our influences and
totally,
what's where things have come from.
Because when we talk about global majority, like I am interested in what Indian theatre makers are doing now, but I also know it'll be like if I was just sitting there going, I know. I'm doing finger guns if you can't see. Like, again, it's a lot, like, it allows a space for curiosity and not an assumption of knowledge on my part. I am fascinated in different ways of doing things, but I also know the different ways of doing things are from a space and a time which is completely divorced from my heritage.
Oh my gosh, absolutely.
Yeah, and that's a cute, you know, it's cute, and I can't hold that. And it's so it is, I think when we talk about what dramaturgy in a global majority form is, I think it is really important to make the distinction between how that sits differently for diaspora theatre makers and theatre makers who are originating that work and the places that they're from and that bringing that over.
Yeah. That's a great place to finish, I think. We've run out of time.
Oh, God, sorry. I'm so sorry.
That was fascinating. I wish I could talk to you all day because there were so many points. I was like, marketing, I want to talk about spaces and all that kind of stuff. But we just can't. Maybe another series.
Yeah.
Maybe another series.
Series 4.
But listen, thank you so much, Izzy and Vinay, for being so open and generous with your conversations. We really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Thanks for having us.
And yeah, thank you for joining us today.
Cheers, guys.
Cheers.
Bye. Cheers. Thank you.
Shout out to you.
If you love this episode, then please do share it with your friends and maybe even leave a cheeky review.
And for more of Tell Them, don't forget to subscribe and follow us on our socials for episode drops.
Join us for episode 3, where we're going to be chatting to Nathan Powell and Kane Husbands.